From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The sun has risen and set on Major League Baseball's opening day, held fittingly in the land of the rising sun. Ahead on Only a Game, a report from Japan and a conversation with Alan M. Klein, author of Growing the Game, the Globalization of Major League Baseball. Also a preview of the women's and an update of the men's NCAA Basketball Regionals. Also ahead, the fan club which calls itself the Sons of Ben looks 2 years into the future when their yet-to-be-named MLS franchise will begin to play in Philadelphia.
I was born in 82, so I can't remember any championship, and I'm starred myself, so actually I think there will be a greater chance for a championship coming from the soccer team that doesn't even exist yet.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Badgers were not stinking, saying that would be too cruel. And anyone who brings up stinking Badgers is a fool. But thanks to Lowly Davidson, a humble number 10, the tourney will not need the Badgers when it starts again. Lest that seem puzzling, the Badgers of Wisconsin, a number 3 seed, lost to Davidson last night, 73-56. Giant killer Davidson will play Giant Kansas tomorrow. In other men's NCAA tournament action, Texas beat Stanford 82-62, Kansas got by upstart Villanova 72-57, and Memphis, the number one seed, still claiming to be an underdog, overwhelmed Michigan State 92-74. The four winners will make up half of this year's Elite Eight. Today and tomorrow, the Elite Eight in the women's tournament will be determined. All four number one seeds, Connecticut, Maryland, University of North Carolina, and Tennessee, have prevailed with relative ease so far. Joining me now to discuss what awaits those teams and a few of the exceptional performances in the first two rounds is Michelle Smith, who writes about women's basketball for the San Francisco Chronicle. Michelle, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
There haven't been many upsets in this tournament, unless you count Baylor, a number 3 seed, losing to Pitt, a number 6, and George Washington, another 6, getting by California, a 3. Does it make you long for the days when Harvard at 16 knocked off Stanford at number 1?
Oh, I'd get in such trouble from the coach I cover if I said yes. You know, it's been a true-to-form tournament, definitely, I would say, to this point. I think things get more interesting from here on out. And, you know, those 3 and 6 games are not huge upsets by tournament standards, but by the women's tournament standards, because, you know, because upsets are fewer and far between, those were pretty good wins.
Speaking of Stanford, as we were a minute ago, there have been some great individual performances in the early going. Candace Wiggins scored 44 points, exactly half of her team's points, in their 34-point win over University of Texas at El Paso. A great night, even by Wiggins' standards?
Yeah, it was an interesting night, because the Cal-George Washington game happened immediately before the Stanford game started. And, you know, they're in the same conference, and Cal has been trying to, you know, upgrade that program. And so the Stanford players stood in the wings, not really a tunnel, but the wings, and watched Cal lose that game, knowing that they had lost their second-round game the previous year on their Florida State.
Mm-hmm.
So then Wiggins went, and we were standing in the hall waiting to go in to talk to Cal, and Wiggins was giving this fire and brimstone pregame speech to her teammates about, nobody's giving this to us, we have to take this. It was very fiery for her. And, you know, she always looks like such the perpetually nice kid. Not that this wasn't nice, but it was just very fiery and very emotional. And then went out and just basically said, and I'm winning this game. And did, you know, and hit every shot and hit him from everywhere and was basically unstoppable. And then just, you know, as an addendum, Jane Appel goes 9 for 9 from the field to add another 20 points to it. And they're playing really, really well. It's going to be an interesting region out in Spokane with Maryland and Stanford.
We've seen a couple of marvelously close games. Notre Dame needed overtime to beat Oklahoma, 79-75, and the same was true of Old Dominion when they beat Virginia, 88-85. Are teams that have won their first two games by 30 or 40 points ever at a disadvantage against teams that have had to win squeakers to advance?
No, not necessarily. I think you know, every game that you play is going to end your season. So I think that no matter what happens in the previous game, you get a clean slate. I think that that's sort of the interesting thing about this tournament, is that I think you can play badly, you can play a close game, and you can come back. I mean, it's just, it's not quite the same carryover as the regular season, because there's always another game after that. This is it. So wipe the slate clean, start over again, and I think largely you see that in the tournament.
I mentioned that the number one seeds, Connecticut, Maryland, UNC, and Tennessee, had all advanced, but which, if any, of the other 12 teams still in the tournament have played well enough to make you think they might beat a number one seed?
Well, we talked about Stanford, and I think that's a Stanford and Maryland, I think that that could be a very even game. Their seedings were even. Stanford was the two. If you go by the committee's S-curve, Maryland was the last of the number one seeds, and Stanford was the first of the number two seeds, so you could probably flip those two teams fairly easily. I think LSU is good enough to get back to the Final Four and will be playing, in theory, against North Carolina in New Orleans, which is, you know, in theory, a home court advantage, though they won't be necessarily on their home floor. I just think that there's some interesting matchups, but I think most of them are between one and two seeds. I don't think you're going to stretch too far into the brackets to see the teams that are going to come out into the Final Four this year.
The cliche has it that you're supposed to take it one game at a time, but it's hard not to look ahead at the possibility that Tennessee and Connecticut will meet in the championship game. What baggage? The coaches of the teams, Pat Summitt and Gino Auriemma, no longer speak to one another. The teams no longer play each other during the regular season because the coaches couldn't agree on how that should happen. To what extent, if any, has this feud trickled down to the players?
You know, it's hard to say at this point, because I don't think that the coaches have encouraged kids to talk about it at all. I think that if people are asking about it, you know, in tournament it's taboo to talk about anything other than the next game. And mostly in the regular season it is too, but particularly in the tournament. I think that if anybody asked Tennessee a question about Connecticut at this point, you know, the hammer would come down. But, I think it's going to be a circus. I think it's going to be hilarious. I think that there's a lot of people that are waiting to see this happen, because these seem to be the two best teams in the country. It seems to be sort of this destiny matchup after everything that's happened. And I think that it's sort of funny. I'm not sure when Pat Summitt canceled the regular season series, you know, we know by now that she had reasons for doing it that she doesn't want to talk about. But the byproduct of it being that now that if they end up playing in the national championship game, it's going to be an utter and complete, you know, sideshow, is very funny.
Well, so
it's interesting.
So I assume that if Stanford can't get by Pitt and then Maryland and then Connecticut, you are among those hoping for a UConn-Tennessee final.
Oh, absolutely. For the entertainment value alone.
Michelle Smith covers women's basketball for the San Francisco Chronicle and discusses the game with me from time to time on Only a Game. Thanks very much, Michelle.
Thank you.
Major League Soccer begins its 13th season today, but in Philadelphia, you can't blame fans if they're looking 2 years down the road. That's when their newly awarded MLS team will start playing. The team doesn't even have a name yet, but there is a rapidly growing supporters group known as the Sons of Ben, which formed over a year ago, and they have been doing everything from recruiting season ticket holders to antagonizing fans in other MLS cities. Eugene Son reports.
You're probably asking, why would anybody form a fan club for a team that doesn't exist? Brian James, president of the Sons of Ben, says people got so excited in 2006 when there was talk about moving the Kansas City soccer team here that even when that fell through, a bunch of them decided it was time for Philadelphia soccer fans to unite. The Sons of Ben was born in January 2007. Its logo is a skull and crossbones with a crack running through it like the Liberty Bells. It sports bifocals like the ones worn by the group's namesake, Ben Franklin. James says the Sons of Ben number over 2,000, and they've recruited hundreds to buy season tickets.
Just for the Sons of Ben sections, which will probably be behind a goal, we've already sold 700 season tickets. That's comparable to DC United, which has been around for 13 years now.
I caught up with James at a mall around the corner from his downtown Philadelphia office. The business analyst has been besieged with interview requests since Major League Soccer awarded Philly its team last month. James says the Sons of Ben want to recruit passionate fans, but ones that will stay positive.
It'll be a group that cheers on the home team regardless of performance for 90 minutes. And then at the end of the game, we'll let them have it. But we think it's counterproductive to call yourself a supporters group and then boo every single incident that happens on the field during the game.
That's a big distinction in Philadelphia, where even superstars get booed frequently, and Eagles fans once pelted Santa Claus with snowballs. Sons of Ben Vice President Dave Flagler is one of a dozen diehards watching English Premier League soccer on satellite at an Irish pub 9 a.m. on a Sunday. He says the team's debut cannot come soon enough.
It's probably going to be the longest 2 years of all of our lives.
The soccer fans around him would be perfect people to recruit for Sons of Ben, but Flagler says he's too shy to talk them up, and he's not going to make the hard sell on anyone.
We're not so concerned with converting the people who are the anti-soccer people. I mean, we really can't be bothered. The people we really need to convert are the people who say that MLS isn't exciting, the people that say there are many more better leagues out there.
Jeff Butchko sits a few tables away with his wife, Denise. They drove in from the New Jersey suburbs to watch the English League action. He is skeptical if MLS will ever compete at the same level.
I don't think it's comparable, but at the same time, I think it's good to go see. I enjoy watching all the teams, the young players come along. Seems more like a feeder league than a big league like England, but still worth going to see.
Over at the bar sits Fred Smith, an English expatriate, who says Philadelphia's team needs high-caliber fans as much as it does talented players.
It's very, very passionate, and the fans are incredible over there. I'd love to see that, you know, transplanted to this country.
The Sons of Ben are doing everything they can to build that kind of raucous fan base. They already have club scarves and a song. They've been invading MLS games in other cities. This is audio from a Sons of Ben YouTube posting from when they went to the MLS Cup final last year. It was the Houston Dynamo versus the New England Revolution. All around the Sons of Ben, the Revolution fans grew increasingly annoyed by this group without a team. Frank Gias isn't surprised by the growth of Sons of Ben. Gias is the soccer writer for the Newark Star-Ledger and covers the New York Red Bulls.
Philadelphia has always supported soccer. It's just that the leagues have folded, the NASL and the WSA, but the fans were there.
Gias says MLS wanted a team in Philadelphia 13 seasons ago, but it's taken until now to work out a stadium deal. Back at the bar, Sons of Ben member Todd Pito says it will be easy to attract fans if the soccer team wins. And given that Philadelphia's baseball, basketball, football, and hockey teams haven't won a championship since 1983, he thinks some fans will welcome any opportunity to end that drought.
I was born in 82, so I can't remember any championship, and I'm starved myself. So actually, I think there will be a greater chance for a championship coming from the soccer team. It doesn't even exist yet.
For Only a Game, I'm Eugene Son in Philadelphia.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Spectators at the Beijing Olympics will have the opportunity to profit from the games, assuming they can correctly guess how many gold, silver, and bronze medals Chinese athletes will win in various sports. A state-run Olympic-themed lottery, which will have prizes of up to 5 million yuan, or $709,000, will include games allowing fans to bet on the winners of preliminary rounds, competitions, and medalists covering all 28 sports on each day of the competition. Gambling was banned in China by the Communist Party in 1949, but if you bet state-run sports lotteries have been very popular in China since they began in the 1980s, hey, you win! I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, Tim Kirkjian's annual existential take on the Yankees. But first, on Tuesday, unless it was Wednesday, in a time zone far, far away, the world champion Boston Red Sox opened their 2008 season against the Oakland Athletics in Tokyo. The games featured the homecomings of second-year Boston pitchers Daisuke Matsuzaka and Hideki Okajima. They were part of Major League Baseball's ambitious plan to spread its brand worldwide. Only a Game's Ken Shulman reports from Tokyo.
Few lands fuse tradition with technology the way Japan does. Shinkansen bullet trains slice through the sacred shadow of Mount Fuji. Buddhist temples stand minutes away from raucous karaoke bars. Baseball, too, is a beguiling mix of old and new, with rituals that are both familiar and foreign to Western eyes.
The amount of effort put into practice is huge. The kinds of things that are called training extend deep into what we would consider our personal time in space.
Mary White is an American anthropologist, currently living in Kyoto, Japan's old capital. She says Japanese players follow rigid regimens and diets and often abstain from alcohol and sex. East is East, and West is West. But the twain do meet in baseball. Second-tier major leaguers have made new lives in Japan since the 60s. More recently, Japanese legends like Hideo Nomo and Ichiro Suzuki crossed the Pacific and established themselves as legitimate major league stars. But White says Japanese wunderkind Daisuke Matsuzaka is a different story.
There's a word here, kawaiko-chan, means cute boy, cute kid. And everybody loves a cute kid. And he's seen as developing. He's seen as at the start of something wonderful. He's not seen as fully mature. He's seen as learning stage. So everybody's following him as if they were following their own child.
Matsuzaka may be a magnet for maternal angst here, but he's also a rock star. And it's not just because of his smile or swagger. Tomoko Matsuri is assistant manager at the Clubhouse, an MLB merchandise store that opened last year in Tokyo's hip Shibuya district.
He has a large following of female fans because he became famous and went overseas when he was still young. Yes, he's very cute, but most of all, we can tell he's working very hard. That's what we like about him.
Teen idol or Spartan icon, Boston's $103 million baby didn't get much love from the Oakland Athletics on Tuesday. More surprisingly, the sellout Tokyo Dome crowd seemed almost indifferent. There was no thunderous ovation when he took the hill, no sunburst of digital flashes all firing at once. It sure didn't feel like the return of the prodigal Kawaiko-chan, especially after Oakland's Mark Ellis drove Daisuke's third pitch into the left center seats. But maybe it was the company he was keeping. American expat Marty Kienert is an executive with the Rakuten Eagles, a team in Japan's Pacific League. He was a play-by-play announcer in Japan for 25 years.
Well, with Japanese players, they know the history of the guys much better than the American players. You know, these guys that are fans here have seen the players since they've been in the Koshien tournament when they're, you know, first year in high school. And then if they happen to go on to college, they follow their careers in college. And then they go into pro ball. So they know the history there. They can really know who these people are long before they became professionals. The hardcore group here in Japan that likes Major League Baseball probably only knows about these guys from the time they get into pro ball and only after they've become stars.
Japanese fans are thrilled when homegrown stars earn top billing and top dollar in Seattle and New York and Boston. Still, they prefer their baseball because it's their baseball. The annual summer Koshien High School Tournament, where Daisuke first vaulted onto the national stage in 1998, draws huge TV audiences here. Those hardcore Japanese fans who tune into MLB broadcasts do so mainly to watch Japanese players. In Japanese sports pages, the Seattle Mariners don't beat Anaheim. Ichiro does. For most fans here, North American baseball is like a foreign film, with Japanese players for subtitles. The MLB may well be better than the domestic brand, but it's hard to care about. The MLB season opener was far from pretty and far from Japanese, but it was exciting, with several lead changes, several defensive gems, and even some sloppy base running. Most importantly, despite the culture shock, despite the spring training cobwebs, the teams refused to quit. Strength of will is a Japanese virtue, too. When Boston reliever Hideki Okajima came on with the score tied at 4-all at the top of the ninth, the dome was rocking. when Manny, just being Manny Ramirez, almost forgot to run to second on a two-run double in the 10th, the crowd went berserk. They weren't necessarily rooting for Boston. They were rooting for heart, something that both teams had shown, and that can never be lost in translation. The Tokyo crowd might not have been able to read the lyrics of this American melodrama, but they got enough of the story to want to sing along. For Only a Game, I'm Ken Schulman in Tokyo, Japan.
The premature beginning to the Major League Baseball season may have confused some fans, but ESPN's Tim Kirkchen was no doubt prepared for it, as he is for all things baseball, and he joins me now. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
Great to be here, Bill.
We've just heard about the Red Sox and the A's in Japan. After playing twice in Tokyo, the Sox flew to Los Angeles for three exhibition games against the Dodgers. Tomorrow, they'll resume playing games that count, and they'll be playing Oakland again. Do the benefits to Major League Baseball outweigh the various drawbacks of this intercontinental adventure?
I guess they do, Bill. I guess in the revenue department and the growing the game department, baseball does very well with the whole trip to Japan. However, when you think about how this goes, the Red Sox have to change their entire spring training, as do the A's, and they are creatures of habit. They work on schedules, and the schedules got completely fouled up. And the hardest part is going over there and playing a bunch of exhibition games and then playing two games that count and then coming back and playing more exhibition games. It's really difficult. Once you start the season, you start the season. The Red Sox and A's are starting the season, then they're stopping the season, then they're starting it again. And I think it will affect both teams. Now, this happened to the Mets in 2000. Steve Phillips, their GM, told me we just sleepwalked for a week after that, but they ended up winning the division. So everyone will forget about this in a couple of weeks.
One person who would be happy to see the Red Sox play more games in Japan and then perhaps some in Australia and a few in Guam or maybe on a snake-infested coral reef is Hank Steinbrenner. He's been insulting the Bostons, Tim. How much of that is Mr. Steinbrenner just stepping into a role that his father created?
It's just him having a little bit of fun, and I frankly don't have any problem with this. I don't think we have enough of this anymore. George Steinbrenner will never get that from him again, sadly. So who better to take the reins than his son? I don't think he means most of the stuff he says. But he's a beat writer's, you know, absolute dream guy, because you call him anytime, he answers the phone, and he'll say whatever you want him to say, pretty much. So sometimes it's good for the game, and when he gives you the whole, you know, nobody loves the Red Sox, this is a Yankee country still, first off, it's just not true, but B, I think it's kind of fun, and I think it's just another way to fuel a great, great rivalry.
This afternoon in Memphis, the New York Mets and the Chicago White Sox will play in something Major League Baseball is calling the diversity game, and I guess it's fair to say the Mets are the right choice to play in such a game.
Well, they are, and they're, you know, with a Latin American general manager in Omar Minaya and a African American manager in Willie Randolph, they're the perfect team to play in this. And baseball really has to look at this very closely, because I believe the latest numbers are 8% of the major league players now are African-American players, and that's just unacceptable in every way for Major League Baseball. Something has to be done about this, and this kind of game is the kind of game that, you know, brings this to light to some degree. But it's not just African-American players. The Mets are about everybody on their team. They have so many Latin American players, and over the years they've had Japanese players and everyone else all the way down the line. So they're a great melting pot there in one team, and they are a pretty good team.
Tim, as you mentioned, besides showcasing diversity, the Mets are a pretty good ball team, and they have acquired the best available free agent pitcher. So what do you think? Do they win the National League pennant?
I think the Mets are going to win the National League pennant, Bill, but there are 9 teams in that league that can win the National League pennant. That is the beauty of that league. Again this year, there are no great teams, including the Mets. There are a couple of bad teams, but mostly there are a bunch of pretty good teams. 3 from the East, two from the Central, four from the West, all have a chance to go to the World Series for me. And that's going to be the real beauty of the National League. Keep in mind, no NL team won more than 90 games last year. And I could see that happening again. Johan Santana, I believe, is going to pitch the Mets back to the playoffs. But to say they're a great team right now, I don't think it's true.
Well, we'll get back to the National League in just a minute. But on Tuesday, I heard one of your colleagues, Peter Gammons, pick the Cleveland Indians to win the American League pennant. Do you share his opinion?
I don't. I've got the Red Sox winning the pennant. At the same time, Bill, there are, you know, again, six or seven teams in the American League that have a real chance. The Indians were one win away from going to the World Series last year. This is the 60th anniversary of the last time they won the World Series, so why not? I think they're a slightly better team than they were last year, but they have one big if. CeCe Sabathia, their ace, who was the Cy Young winner but was terrible in the playoffs last year, he turned down a four-year deal for $17.5 million, and I just wonder privately if he's going to, you know, if he's going to be okay this year with a contract hanging over his head. I picked them to win the division. You win the division, you can go to the World Series, but I'm sticking with the Red Sox.
Tim, I'm sure you've been traveling throughout Florida and Arizona to visit various teams. Maybe you visited all of them. Where, if anywhere, did you find surprises?
Well, I did go to Surprise, Arizona, but I didn't find too many surprises where I went. The Cincinnati Reds are one team to really keep your eye on. Just in case, they have a new manager in Dusty Baker, my former colleague at ESPN, and there's just no way Dusty is going to go to a place that has this history of losing. They've had seven straight losing seasons, and just accept that, again, he's going to do something about it, and I think he has this spring. But that's about the only team that I think even has a remote chance of coming out of nowhere and surprising. And a lot of things are going to have to happen if it's going to happen for the Reds. But every year, Bill, and I've told you this many times, there's a surprise team that just makes us slap our forehead and say, where did that come from? Just once, I'd like to be the guy that picks that team at the beginning of the year.
See, I was really hoping that you would say you were astonished at how well the Cubs had meshed.
Well, Bill, they're not a surprise team. They went to the playoffs last year. They are going to win that division, and I'm telling you, if everything works right for them, they will celebrate their 100th year without a World Series by winning the World Series. That could happen. And anyone who's a baseball fan, you know, has to at least look at that and say, boy, this would be the best story of the year. It would be better even than Joe Torre coming back to New York as a Dodgers manager and winning the World Series, or the Indians winning for the first time in 60 years. The Cubs winning for the first time in 100 years, that's the story, and it could happen.
All right, we have a sense of which teams you think may very well meet in the World Series, and now it's time for you to give us the winner in each division and the 2008 champ.
Okay, I'm going to take the Red Sox, the Indians, and the Mariners, surprise, with the injuries to the Angels, to win the divisions in the American League, with the Yankees winning the wild card. And, Bill, I am almost alone on the Yankees making the playoffs. All my friends say there's no way. In the National League, I'm going to take the Mets, the Cubs, and the Dodgers, with the Phillies as the wild card. And I got a real chance to be really wrong in the National League, as well as the American League. And then I think the Red Sox are going to play the Mets in the World Series, and I think the Red Sox are going to repeat.
ESPN's Tim Kirkton joins me from time to time to talk about baseball, for which I am grateful each time. Thanks very much, Tim.
My pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
You're listening to Only a Game. Next week at the NFL owners' meeting in Palm Beach, the men who run the No Fun League will take on the issue of whether players should be allowed to wear their hair long. We think that meeting might go something like this.
This meeting of the subcommittee to consider players' hair length will come to order. Order!
Chili dog and a Charleston chew.
Not that kind of order.
Okay, steak and lobster.
No, we're here to talk about hair. Specifically, hair is worn by players like Troy Polamalu.
What kind of name is Polamalu?
It's Polamalu's name, but he wears his hair so long you can't see his name on the back of his jersey.
Then how do we know it's him?
Who?
Polamalu.
Oh, yeah, I know him. He's the guy who wears his hair really long. Black hair, curly. I'd know him anywhere, no problem.
Well, it is a problem. The name on the back, that's part of his uniform. Players can't
Maybe we could ask him to tuck his hair under his helmet.
He'd need a big hat.
A big hat. That'd be funny. Big hat. I wore a big cowboy hat to a wedding reception one time. It was funny. Had lots of laughs. Big hat.
The point here is discipline.
And somebody threw it in the fountain. I went right the night after the big hat. Everyone laughed at that, too. Funny. Big hat in the fountain.
Discipline!
Right. And uniformity. Oh, the big hat!
Right, right. And not funny. Nothing funny about the NFL.
So we're all agreed. No hair so long that it covers the name on the back of the uniform.
Right. Otherwise, nobody will know who it is.
Well, unless it's Troy Polamalu. He's the guy with the really long hair. Can't miss him.
Discipline!
Right,
aye.
Right,
aye.
So it's settled. No more long hair. Let's move on. Should the league be paying attention to the long-term implications of concussions suffered by players?
Move to table.
Second.
Aye. Like pirates. Arg. Wooden leg. Funny. Like a big hat.
Move to adjourn.
Lobster. Hat.
And so another critical issue in the world of sports is resolved, and the U.S. Congress didn't even have to get into it. If you're a member of the Weekend Late Risers Club or find yourself otherwise indisposed when Only a Game hits the conventional airwaves, please go to onlyagame.org and click on podcast. Show it long as God can do it. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Charles River Apparel, introducing Charles River Sport, a new line of wicking polos and tees in a variety of team colors, charlesriverapparel.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Going to the chapel and we're gonna get married. Going to the chapel and we're gonna get married.
Last Saturday, Mark Confer and Joanne Wainwright took the plunge, literally, having slid down a 136-foot chute into the Nikisi Pool in Nikisi, Alaska. Confer and Wainwright surfaced and were wed. Their wedding cake was shaped like a pool. Atop it crouched a tiny bride and groom on a diving board, each prepared to go right off the deep end. Both about to be sunk. Prepared to live happily ever after. Yeah, that's what I meant. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the globalization of baseball. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Seattle Supersonics owner Clay Bennett and a gaggle of Oklahoma State and city officials made a presentation to NBA Commissioner David Stern and three very impressed team owners on Tuesday. Will OK City be okayed as an NBA venue?
Well, I mean, as far as utterly shameless and graceless public blackmail goes, this was about as smooth as it gets. Whatever that team will be called in the future will be playing its games in Oklahoma City, and I hope Oklahoma City's happy, because in 5 years there's going to be another ambitious city, and this guy is going to be looking elsewhere for another sweetheart deal, and Oklahoma City's going to look like fools, and I hope the Seattle people laugh at them.
Mr. Bennett has said that he's willing to let Seattle keep the team nickname and the colors and the 41-year history, whatever that means. Do you think Seattle officials will be sufficiently swayed by that offer to gracefully allow Mr. Bennett to depart?
I think they'll drive him to the border myself. But the idea that the NBA is going to put another team in Seattle after knuckling them the way they did over this whole thing is pretty ludicrous.
The latest man who will be charged with fixing the New York Knicks will apparently be Donnie Walsh, currently the chief executive of the Indiana Pacers. Have you any reason to believe that Mr. Walsh can turn the Knicks around?
No, because Coach Stupid will still be on the sidelines, because for some reason James Dolan, the owner of the New York Knickerbockers, thinks that Isaiah Thomas is just the man to fix the mess that Isaiah Thomas created. This is a retirement plan for Donnie Walsh. It's his last stop in the league. He's got a 3-year, $15 million deal. He'll cash the checks. Isaiah will act like a jackass. Maybe Dolan will finally wise up or get his cat out of the clouds or stop taking delivery of the mushrooms or whatever it is that makes him continue to employ this loser and get rid of him. But other than that, Donnie Walsh is just in this for the bucks.
Since last we spoke, Charlie, Marquette lost to Stanford in the men's NCAA tournament. Have you continued to pay attention to the dance since then?
I have. I mean, it's been hard through tear-dimmed eyes, but I have. It's bad enough to lose to a team full of scholars, but it's worse to lose to a team full of scholars when one of them looks like Sideshow Bob from The Simpsons. Anyway, North Carolina has...
No bitterness there.
None at all. None at all. None at all. None at all. You tree can bite me, too, for that matter. Anyway, North Carolina's far and away been the most impressive team, but the second most impressive team... as we move along, have been the Louisville Cardinals, who really took Tennessee apart. Tennessee, of course, was ranked number one for a while this season, and Louisville made them look like children the other night, especially in the second half. They won they won 42-30 in the second half and won by 19. Right now, I would give Louisville a very good chance at beating North Carolina.
In the women's tournament, the only remaining teams that could be considered long shots are number six seeds, Pittsburgh and George Washington. They each face number two seeds this weekend. Would you agree that it looks as if we're heading toward predictable confrontations in that Final Four?
Well, this is all kinds of chalk, and unfortunately for women's basketball, it remains all kinds of chalk. Pittsburgh may have a shot at beating Stanford, but that's the only upset I see.
In baseball news, a psychic named Monty Farber said this week that the New York Yankees and the San Francisco Giants would play in the World Series next fall. So is this a psychic who fell on his head this spring?
I mean, psychics are supposed to have, you know, cosmically better names than Monty. You know, I don't, you know, I wouldn't go to a doctor named Spike, and I wouldn't go to a psychic named Monty. So, no, I don't have a lot of faith in the guy, to be honest with you, Bill.
I hope the Giants do, because that's the only way they're going to have any faith this time around.
But they are scrubbing the bad hex and voodoo out of their stadium.
That's absolutely right. AT&T Park, the home of the San Francisco Giants, has been cleansed of all images of Barry Bonds. I don't know who we should attribute this to, Stalin's ghost, the KGB, or Commissar Bud.
It's really remarkable. It is as thoroughgoing a thing as you would see in the Soviet Union. Even the number 756 is being completely purged. I wonder if the individual digits 7, 5, and 6 will not be pure either, because people will get confused finding their seats.
Alex Rodriguez says that he is not worried about Jose Canseco's new book and what he has to say in it. Should he be worried?
Who knows? I mean, anybody who takes Jose Canseco, embattled truth teller, as seriously as a character in our national dialogue deserves what they get. He supposedly, Canseco introduced Rodriguez to a steroid dealer named Max. Now, While I don't trust psychics named Monty, Max is a perfectly plausible name for a steroid dealer. The problem, of course, being Canseco won't identify Max as anything but Max. So, no, I don't believe Jose is trafficking in necessarily the whole truth here.
The National Football League's owners will vote next week on a rule that would limit the length of players' hair. Is this a matter of neatness counts, or is there something more significant at stake?
Well, supposedly it's a safety thing, but the NFL always says that. The NFL is incredibly anal about anything that it perceives as being ununiform, and I think this we can safely call this the Troy Polamalu Act of 2008.
There are some who are very concerned about ultimate fighting, a very violent and often bloody martial arts form. But now there is even more concern after it was learned that kids in Missouri are taking part in ultimate fighting contests and that some of those kids are as young as 6 years old. What do you make of what those who are in favor of the sport say about its benefits?
They need to get with some marketing people really quick, because this guy Tommy Bloomer, the father of two of a group called the Garage Boys Fight Crew, is explaining, we're not training them for dogfighting. I think we need to raise the bar a little bit higher than that, actually.
I go along with that.
And it says, it looks violent until you realize this teaches discipline. Mm. The kids learn to respect and how to defend themselves. It's no more dangerous than any other sport. Yes, it's more dangerous than golf. It's more dangerous than tennis. It's probably more dangerous than baseball. Do not look at me and think I'm that stupid, people.
Charlie, you may be the world's greatest authority on the attempt to maintain the public relations image of Tiger Woods. It took a bit of a hit recently.
Yeah, apparently he's got a problem that no other golfer in the history of golf has had, namely that 8,000 people follow him around with cameras. And he went to the backswing and somebody clicked, and he went off with an absolute tirade where he threatened to, like, choke the guy, only it was sort of like effing choke the guy. And now it became a thing, and he had to explain himself on ESPN and blah, blah, blah. And I think that a lot of the delicate flower golf etiquette stuff is a lot of nonsense. But there really are more guys with cameras following this guy than any golfer in history. It really is an unprecedented problem.
Finally, Charlie, airlines concerned about security might consider hiring rugby teams. What do you think of that plan?
Apparently, there was on this airplane, Bill, a South African rugby team, and somebody that the wire service describes as, quote, an obnoxious drunk who was remarkably not a member of the rugby team. And the members of the rugby team, who have infinitely more experience than most people in quieting obnoxious drunks, including themselves, quieted this guy down to the benefit of their other passengers and probably entertained him by sitting on him and singing a whole bunch of dirty songs.
Charlie Fierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe. He joins me each week here at Only a Game. Thank you very much, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
Oh, I have slipped the surly bonds of earth and danced the skies on laughter-silvered wings. Sunward I've climbed.
You can listen at leisure to Only a Game podcasts or to programs past and present by visiting our website, onlyagame.org.
Wheeled and soared and swung high in the sunlit silence. Hovering there, I've chased the shouting wind along and flung my eager craft through footless halls of air. Up, up the long...
The two-game series with which the Boston Red Sox and Oakland Athletics opened the Major League Baseball season in Tokyo this week is the most recent manifestation of Major League Baseball's attempt to go global. In Growing the Game, Alan Klein, a professor of sociology and anthropology at Northeastern University, discusses the trend and its implications for the future of the game. Alan Klein joins me now in the studio. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Let's start from Major League Baseball's relatively recent decision that the game needs to be, quote-unquote, grown. What was the basis of the decision?
Well, you know, there's the straw that breaks the camel's back, and then there's a long-term kind of set of conditions. I think that personally, structurally, there's a lot of problems, despite the amazing revenues and the attendance figures that are touted. The game itself is having a bit of difficulty in reproducing the player base. And simultaneously, there's a problem with the graying of the fan base. It's most notable in the relatively important absence of African-American players in the game. And it didn't take very long for the teams that were ahead of the curve, the Dodgers, Giants, who had been in Latin America, to pass that message along to other teams that there was a need to go outside the U.S. There's just more and better players elsewhere, in certain parts of the world anyway. So it's not a matter of any kind of utopian or altruistic kind of ideas. This is, if you're fast enough, if you're lucky enough, you can compete with the big boys. What it requires is a tad of decentralization. And this is what I have not found with Major League Baseball's efforts. If you look at, for example, the most stellar example would be the World Baseball Classic. It was, by all accounts, highly successful. Mm-hmm. But as I try to point out in the book, it really was virtually on the rocks just 2-3 months before. It was not decentralized at all, and that can cause trouble down the road.
Major League Baseball's connection with Japan has enjoyed some spectacular high points. Babe Ruth was greeted like a god when he played in exhibition games there 70 and more years ago. But I was surprised to learn about efforts to plant baseball in England, Germany, South Africa, among other places. Where has that effort succeeded?
Well, that's a great question. Japan, of course, is the poster child for international baseball in terms of both the players that are beginning to come out of there and the remarkable business opportunities. That success has not been found elsewhere. It's great in Venezuela, the Dominican Republic, Cuba, Japan, and Korea. It's not been so good in Europe. And in Africa, it's virtually unheard of. Europe has been, for all of its efforts, quite a failure. Some people believe you can market yourself into anything or out of anything, but it's not worked there. And I've been arguing that it needs to be more in a place like Eastern Europe. If you want to replicate what you have in the Caribbean, careers in baseball were directly tied to economic opportunity or social mobility. Eastern Europe is perfect for that.
In one of the more memorable images in your book, you describe, quote, the appearance of commodities and objects at the other ends of the earth. Tribesmen wearing Dallas Cowboy caps. They could as easily be Cleveland Indians caps, I guess. In either case, does simply selling merchandise constitute growing the game?
That's a good point. I think for some people, that is what they consider globalization. And I tried to point out that, you know, we saw that in Italy. We saw that in England. In London, there are people wearing New York Yankees caps who have not a clue about what the game is.
Just or like
there
the
is
caps.
A game. Right. They just like the look of it. They like the caps.
There will be baseball at the Beijing Olympics in August, but the International Olympic Committee decided back in 2005 to drop baseball and softball from the games after the Beijing Olympics. To what extent does that represent a setback for those bent on growing the game?
It at first seemed like a significant setback. It took so long to get the game into the Olympics officially, and finally having gotten there, it is, you know, one of the two most global venues for sport, so it's important to be there. However, there was a silver lining. The prospect and then the reality of losing the games in the Olympics ultimately helped to get the WBC started on a fast track. I think that was really languishing.
You write that the National Basketball Association has been by far the most successful organization in terms of international marketing. Has the NBA also been the most successful league in terms of transplanting its game?
Yes, there's no question. I mean, when I listen to Bud Selig get excited about the prospect of having the game being introduced to over 100,000 Chinese youngsters in one of the MLB programs, people in the United States get excited by that prospect. But it's sobering when you come to realize that there are presently over 300 million Chinese playing basketball. So they really did a grassroots effort that paid off.
How are Major League Baseball's efforts most likely to change the game over the next decade or so?
I think that MLB will continue to attempt to play global baseball in exactly the way they have right now, which means essentially minimal change. I don't see that happening. I think that the changes will really come about if and when enough people in the game get serious about the possibility of global franchises. That is the kicker. That's the one that has to happen. If we continue to operate the game out of a North American, primarily U.S. kind of a format, the game will be doomed. So really, globalization has to get beyond just the player base. It has to become capital. It has to become franchises. And that's the future. That's the 21st century, as far as I'm concerned.
So you're talking about a division, for example, a Major League Baseball division that would include a team in Australia or a couple teams in Japan, maybe a team or two in Korea, and they would be in the same division with a team in Southern California and maybe a team in Seattle.
And when you talk about the logistics, I know that the Red Sox just finished playing a two-game series over there, but if you talk about this Pacific Rim division, along those lines, you would do a West Side swing that might take as long as a month. You have two teams in Japan. You have a team or two in Korea. You could build the game eventually in Australia and maybe Taiwan. And you would have be able to play at least 3 weeks of games before you swing back. So it's not as disruptive to the players or their biological clocks. One of the most subtle objections are that the American players wouldn't particularly go for it because they don't want to do that kind of traveling. But if you look at a Southern or Pan American division, as I outlined it in the book, it's quicker to get from Florida to Caracas than it is to take an East Coast to West Coast swing. So, I mean, that's, you know, it's a matter of survival of the game, to be honest with you, because if it's insular the way it continues to be, rather than the way something like FIFA is in Europe, it'll never survive this 21st century.
Alan Klein is a professor of sociology and anthropology at Northeastern University, and he is the author of Growing the Game, The Globalization of Major League Baseball, the paperback edition of which has just been published by Yale University Press. Alan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Phil DiMartino, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our Japanese baseball photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from Tokyo Dome fans who voice their support for an American sports institution. Oh, man, that's gratifying, isn't it? Who knew Japanese fans loved sports radio with opposable thumbs? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.